Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Elizabeth Briety has been involved in cultural change efforts for over 30 years, first at General Motors Research and later through her own consulting practice, Cultural Keys. She has led many career initiatives, including an analysis of AAA mentoring programs, numerous career webinars, and the Career Tools for Anthropology workbook, just published by the Anthropology Career Readiness Network, of which she is one of the founders. Topics discussed include anthropology, employee culture, data science, research science, company culture, alumni speakers, and medical communication. Links to Elizabeth's LinkedIn profile and all the other resources are in the show notes. Today, we have a very special guest who's not a linguist, but is an anthropologist, which is just as good, and there is a tremendous amount of crossover between anthropology and linguistics. So I'd like to welcome Elizabeth Briety to the podcast today. Elizabeth, thank you for your time.
Oh, I'm glad to be here, Laurel. Thanks for inviting me.
This is going to be so interesting. Listeners to the podcast will know that we have been talking with people who are providing resources to folks who are looking to leave academia or just to explore careers outside of academia. And you've been doing that for a while at the Anthropology Career Readiness Network. So we're going to get to talking about that. But before we do it, I would love to hear about your own journey. What got you interested in anthropology? And then what led you to the work that you've done outside of academia?
Well, I took my first anthropology course when I was in college, and I fell in love with the course, and I fell in love with the professor. And she then became my role model. Her name at the time was Ina Dinnerman, and sometime later, she became Ina Rosenthal Urey. She was a Latin Americanist, and I found the way she taught and the content of her courses to be fascinating and something that I wanted to pursue. So we talked about first majoring in anthropology, which I did, you know, at the end of my sophomore year. And then when I was a senior, right before Thanksgiving, I happened to be in her office, and out of the blue, she said, "Well, I think you should go to graduate school." And I looked at her like she had green hair or something. I really wasn't interested in going to graduate school. I was going to be a French teacher in high school. And so this was kind of a problem, because she was so bright, and she seemed to know me better than I knew myself. Anyway, she convinced me to at least apply, which I did. And then I got into University of Texas at Austin, ended up taking a master's and PhD there. And in between those two, she took me on my first fieldwork expedition, which was to Mexico, in the town of Pátzcuaro, which is in the state of Michoacán. And I was hooked.
That's fantastic. I have to ask, through your career, taking these classes as an undergraduate and then your graduate work, did you ever take any linguistics classes?
No, as far as I recall, my college did not offer linguistics. It was a four-year undergraduate college. We only had about 1,200 students. It was Wheaton College in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And then when I got to graduate school, there were linguists, or I should say linguistic anthropologists, on the faculty, and I did have the linguistics core course, but that was about the extent of it, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, you were busy, obviously, getting your anthropology degree. When I was in undergraduate, I took several linguistic anthropology classes, and I was just like, this is amazing. What a kind of crossover with these two things. Sure. It was just so cool. And at that point, I was at Rutgers in New Jersey, and they didn't really have a linguistics program at that point. So the classes were kind of scattered around the different departments, and they had these linguistic anthropology classes offered to the anthro department, and Susan Gall taught them, and she was fantastic. fantastic. Mm. And, you know, she was my mentor and she was the reason I went to graduate school. She said the same thing to me. She said, I think you should go. And I was like, me, really?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
She said, yep, you should absolutely do it. Oh, that's fascinating. Okay. So that's great. So what happened after you finished your PhD?
Well, in my last year of getting a PhD, a friend of mine went to the ASA meetings, the sociology meetings, and came back and said, you know, there is this guy there from General Motors, and he's looking to hire an anthropologist. And so I said, well, why didn't he go to the AAA meetings?
Yeah.
And she said he did, but he didn't find anybody. You should apply. And I said, well, wait a minute now, I'm going to be a professor. Mm-hmm. And basically she said, no, you need to apply. This is good experience, if nothing more. So I did apply. And this person, the contact person, was a sociologist who worked at General Motors. And he was quite interested in pursuing me. He kept asking me for things in the fall of that last year. And I would send him, you know, first my CV, then writing samples, then letters of recommendation. I mean, every time I turned around, he was asking for something. I got home at Christmas time to my parents' house, and 2 days after Christmas, the phone rang, and it was him. And I said, how did you get this number?
Oh, no.
He said, I just called the anthropology department, and they gave it to me.
Oh, well, thanks. Okay, good.
Anyway, there you have it. He wanted me to come out for an interview. I did. By the end of the day, I was sold. I wanted to work at GM, and it had never occurred to me prior to that. It was the research part of GM. At the time, it was called General Motors Research Laboratories. And it was filled with people with advanced degrees and some support staff. But there were about 1,700 people that worked there.
Wow.
And I was fascinated by all these different disciplines working together on projects. And I thought to myself, this is where I want to be. I was much more applications oriented than most people. Most of the people that came out of my program were very theoretically driven. And I always found that theory was, well, not something that I wanted to spend a huge amount of time on. I certainly understood its value and I certainly used it, but I was much more interested in how do we solve this particular problem for this group of people. So going to General Motors, that's exactly what they wanted to done.
Yeah. Oh, that is fascinating. I really want to know, if you don't mind talking about it, what kind of projects were you working on?
Well, one of the first projects that I worked on was involved the families that took overseas assignments for GM. These were people that would live abroad for somewhere between, well, 3 years typically, and then sometimes they would sign up for a second round. They worked in one part of the company that at the time was called General Motors Overseas Operations, where there was sort of a cadre of people that basically wanted overseas assignments for their career. So they might spend a stint, let's say in New Zealand, and then come back to the US for a short period of time and then be off again somewhere else. And that's what they did for their careers. And I thought, wow, this is really interesting. I had not really known much about this before. And I first interviewed the people that were the employees, which in all cases in my initial sample were men. But then later I had the chance to interview spouses. I went to Mexico City and I spent some amount of time there and got a chance to interview spouses and some of the children. And that gave me a lot of insight, not only into how do they prepare for an overseas assignment, particularly if they don't understand the language, what is it like during their period of time in that host country? And then how does it work when they come back home? And I was interested in it from multiple standpoints, the children's standpoint, the spouse's standpoint, and the employee's standpoint. So that was one of the very first projects. And I discovered that General Motors had two different models for sending people abroad. One model, you did this loop where you were like the General Motors overseas operations, and you just took assignment after assignment overseas for your entire career. But at a certain point, they stopped that because they wanted the company to become more global in its orientation. That was the thought process. And it seemed a reasonable thought at the time, except that when the new system kicked in, what ended up happening was that people would take the assignment for 3 years, basically uprooting their families and kids, go somewhere, and then they would come back to the States. And they were typically not sent back to the place where they had left from. So they might have left from, let's say, Chevrolet, and then they would go abroad, and then they would come back to, I don't know, Pontiac. And this then broke the chain. There was no one watching out for their careers. No one was using what they had learned abroad in terms of any kind of cross-cultural understanding, any kind of, you know, maybe we should try it this way. I've seen it work well in this kind of situation. Nope, nobody was interested. Everybody at home knew how they did it here. And besides, what do you know? You haven't even been around here for the last 3 years. So it really ended up being quite divisive. And most of the people that came back in that kind of situation where their repatriation was really troubled left the company. And so then the company, General Motors, basically didn't get a chance to build on what people had learned abroad. And that I thought was a tragedy. So we came up with a variety of recommendations for how they could improve things, because that's, you know, again, the research was applied. So there's a problem. What do we do? Well, the way you solve the problem is you create a loop. So you get people to understand that you start one place, you go abroad, you return to the same place, or at least to a part of the company which has... which is its own unique thing.
So it seems like for this particular project, it was completely internally focused, right? It's about General Motors looking at its own employees and seeing how they're functioning or how they're not functioning, and then looking at how that could be made better. Was any of the work that you did external research on customers or partners or, you know, partnerships in other countries, perhaps?
Later in my career, yes. But early on, I was told, look, we have a whole marketing staff. We would rather have you focus on employees. And I was perfectly content to focus on employees because I wanted to understand how this company worked. I mean, after all, I was an anthropologist, but I considered the company to be a culture or a set of cultures.
Of course.
And so, you know, I had a window into this expat world. In that one project, I had other opportunities to spend time in manufacturing facilities, in sales organizations, you know, in various places. And I really wasn't so interested in the consumer. That was just a bias, I suppose, that I had. But there were so many people doing that kind of work that, and I was the only one doing the employee stuff.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Very forward thinking of them to be looking at their employees in that kind of detail. My own experience working on the marketing side has been that companies are interested in doing that, but they have no idea how to go about doing it and are not even aware of the most basic kind of structures for studying people's behavior and how they communicate and the language that they use and things like that. They're just kind of guessing at it. And they should be hiring people who know what they're doing to give you some actionable results.
Right. I agree with you.
Wow. That's so cool. You know, I'm also, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking that it's changed so much, right? Like big companies, I think, used to recognize the value of investing in their employees like that. But there are so few companies where you're expected to work for more than, you know, 3 to 5 years at a time, that it's just not as common as it used to be. Because if you're only going to be there for 3 years, why should they care about how well you're communicating or working with your coworkers, right? You're just going to be out of there. So the long-term version of working for a company isn't, it's just not as applicable as it used to be.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. And there's also this phenomenon which gets labeled in different ways. But one way of thinking of it is the program of the month. So there's a new buzzword. Mm-hmm. There's a new buzz program. There's a new buzz initiative. And, you know, companies up and down Wall Street are saying, oh, have you tried Agile? Have you tried this? Have you tried that? And you know, there are these patterns where you see that there is a peak in this kind of new programming, and then all of a sudden it kind of slows down and disappears and gets reinvented in something else. Right. And that happens. That's essentially how companies are evolving. If they would stick with something for the long term, it would probably make things a bit better. Now, that's not to say that you shouldn't innovate. Of course you should. But the idea of, stopping working on an initiative that people have just learned to do in order to do a brand new thing that nobody knows how to do, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, business-wise or culturally speaking.
I totally agree. It's funny that, we just went through the huge shift of COVID and people working at home, remote working, and it seems to be wildly understudied how that actually affected the workforce, aside from you see some sound bits here and there. And I just saw a headline the other day saying in a survey, don't know who did the survey, whether it was an academic research thing, but it was some wild number, like 70% of employees say that AI has made their life worse. They made less productive and given them more meaningless, stupid stuff to do, because that's one of those fads that you were just talking about, like, let's incorporate AI into everything. And does it really make life better? Does it make your work better? The answer seems to be no right now.
Interesting.
Super cool. So you worked at General Motors for a while, several decades, right?
24 years.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. And then you transitioned out of that into doing some stuff on your own. So talk about that.
Yes. So General Motors and Chrysler went through a bankruptcy proceedings in 2009. And at that time, all the people that worked at research where I was, who were computer scientists, all the social scientists, all the behavioral scientists, we were all laid off.
Wow.
And so it was just a massive, it was a massive layoff, and it was devastating, of course. You know, whenever you get laid off, and it's devastating, but in particular, because so many people were let go week after week after week. So I thought to myself, okay, what'll I do now? And one thing I knew I was going to do, I had just gotten a book contract. So I knew I was going to write a book, and I had a severance from GM. So that's how I spent the first several months, was writing that book that was Transforming Culture. And it was about my experience working in manufacturing environments, trying to understand how they worked and what would be the secret to making them work better. After I completed the book, it just so happened that a physician called me and said that he had heard about me from another GM employee who was a psychologist, and he was interested in starting up a partnership, and would I help him? And so off we went. He and I and a business person went off to a pharmaceutical company in New Jersey and basically said, here's what we would like to do. We want to make the patient the center of attention, because at that time in 2009, the patient really wasn't. And they had a frame for it. They called it patient-centered medical home. But it really wasn't a very meaningful phrase. And they really wanted to demonstrate how useful it was, how important it was for the patient to basically have someone looking out for you as you need to be sent to different specialists and so on. Mm-hmm. And so we got a ton of money from this one pharmaceutical firm, and then we used it and worked with some hospitals, some doctor's offices to try to help them improve not just their workflow, but get rid of sort of wasted effort when multiple people are doing the same thing, but nobody knows that the other person is doing it. That kind of wasted time and effort. And we also helped in one of the hospitals. Their problem was that PricewaterhouseCoopers had come in and said, you need to cut heads. And they did. They cut 350 people. And so we were dealing with the survivors, much like, you know, in my own case, I was a survivor. So I had this kind of understanding of what people were experiencing as survivors, even though I hadn't survived the same way, but there was this fear. And, you know, running focus groups and trying to understand the perspective that nurses had of physicians of tech staff of orderlies of, you know, billing clerks. I mean, all of the different groups that work together in a hospital setting, trying to understand their perspective. And they were all very frightened because they didn't know when the other shoe was going to drop. Mm-hmm. And so this was the message that we sent back to the people that brought us in. You know, the head cutting has to stop. It's not based on merit. It's a nurse here, a doctor there, and they're gone and nobody knows why. And everybody doesn't know how to respond to that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so this was the kind of work that I started doing more in the medical sphere. And then from there, just branched out into a variety of other industries, including insurance, petrochemicals, university work, you know, a variety of other kinds of organizational cultures to try to understand what was happening inside of them and how could their work be more effective so that people felt good about themselves, good about the contributions they were making, and were really a contributing member of the teams.
Wow, so interesting. I just want to loop back for a second to the first job that you were describing with pharmaceutical companies and then with hospitals. I will tell people that we just finished the linguistics career launch for this summer, which was fantastic. We had a whole panel about medical communication, which is exactly what you were talking about. So many companies now, pharmaceutical companies, healthcare companies, hospitals are looking to improve communication both with patients and internally, and they're seeing the value in hiring linguists and anthropologists and sociologists to take a real rigorous approach to it and actually come up with stuff that's going to help, right? Like to make things better for everybody so that communication is clearer. People feel like they're being heard and understood. And I think just observing all this, especially with all of the cultural differences that we have here in the United States, it's going to be a huge area for employment going forward. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily the translation part of it, although that's certainly part of it. But just being able to communicate to people who have perhaps different cultural expectations about how you interact with the healthcare system, for example.
Right.
You know, the respect for authority or who you talk to or who gets to talk, things like that. It's so important right now. And that trio, the linguists, anthropologists, and sociologists, are just invaluable for getting to the bottom of that kind of stuff and making real recommendations that help.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that you're describing is what is often referred to in the business world as siloing, where each sort of section of a company has its own way of doing things, has its own processes, procedures, work practices, and so on. And they tend to keep to themselves. They don't share necessarily outside of their own areas. And this then becomes a very big problem, particularly in a medical situation where you have different specialty areas within medicine who aren't talking to each other. And they're dealing with a patient that has a complex case. So what can we do to enhance the communication? You know, and they try to do it. You know, they try to have somebody there who sort of is that central core healthcare professional calling in the various specialties to consult on a case. But I think that it has to go beyond that. Mm-hmm. When you are, let's say, an ENT, you also are a doctor, general. You're a general doctor, right? I mean, that's where you were that's where you came from. Those were your roots. And so there, it seems to me there has to be a lot more effort to use your ENT training, but to go back to your roots so that you are thinking more holistically, because you get too much in the ENT weeds, and then things that are things that you know but do not articulate don't get stated, and everybody's so busy working in their own silo that the patient's diagnosis can be missed, and that's a very tricky problem. And it's not just medicine that encounters that. It's widespread. It's all over the corporate world.
Yeah, totally agree. I think you see it most dramatically in medicine because it's literally life or death, right? Yes. If people aren't being diagnosed or if they're not getting their questions answered or they don't know how to follow the instructions, all of that stuff. That's just so interesting. So taking off from here, you are the founder of the Anthropology Career Readiness Network. How did that idea come around?
Well, I was fortunate to be the winner of the Malinowski Award in 2020, and I had to prepare a speech to give at the Society for Applied Anthropology meetings. That's when COVID hit. They have their meetings in March. And so the speech was actually postponed a year, which was fine. Did it by Zoom in 2021. But because of that, I started thinking about my career more from the standpoint of, well, what exactly have I done in my work? What would be my areas of focus? And the more I thought about it, the more I realized even going back to my master's degree, every single project I had has been associated with organizations in some way, shape, or form. And I thought, this is interesting. Why aren't the anthropologists working in organizations? We're all in the community. And that's great. I mean, you know, communities have problems too, but there's a huge number of problems in organizational settings. And yet the anthropologists are nowhere to be seen. So my goal in that speech was to bring attention to basically the silence, the lack of attention to anything related to organizations. And I'm speaking very broadly here. There were a few people that were working in organizational settings. But when you think of traditional anthropological fieldwork, you're out in the world. You're out in a small community, usually, or in an urban center, but in a small neighborhood, and that's your palette. No one was going in to study a national labs, for example. No one was going in to study, a tire manufacturer. No one. So we weren't seeing that. That was not how you did it. You didn't rely on contacts. You did to a certain extent. You may have had an entree into the community you were going to be studying, but it wasn't tied with organizations. And I thought, this is odd, and it needs to. We need to change this. This is not good. So my speech kind of started trying to motivate anthropologists to think differently about organizations. They are not big, bad, and ugly. No more so than communities are. So,
right.
So why aren't we in there? And we can do a whole lot of good if we were. And then I thought, well, what else are organizations good for besides, you know, being the site of research? Well, guess what? They employ people. Mm-hmm. And anthropologists mm-hmm. need employment. Huh, double whammy. So my pitch was, we need organizations and they need us. And at the end of it, I said, we need to do something to help not just the students who will be facing a job market where there are fewer and fewer academic jobs, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, but we mm-hmm. also need to help the instructors, the faculty members, learn more about organizational life, organizational culture, organizational change. And then, of course, all the things that you were talking about related to consumers, customers, users, partners, suppliers, you know, name your favorite entity or favorite group of people that are connected with organizations, and learn how those entities function. And then that way you are positioned better to help those organizations change because you actually have worked inside them, whether as a researcher, as a full-time employee, or later perhaps as a consultant. And you can hopefully find ways to start internships for students that would benefit from spending time in organizational settings. Mm-hmm. So that was the whole point. And I said, I think that we need to do this. And as soon as this meeting is over, I'm going to be contacting some of the anthropology associations, of which there are many, to see if they have an interest in working on this with me. And so that's when it started. The speech was given in March of 2021, and May of 2021, we had our first organizing meeting of the what is now called the network, the Anthropology Career Readiness Network.
So I just have to ask you, how was that received at the time? I mean, I am so on top of everything that you're saying. We've had the same conversation with linguistics departments across the country. Yep. And the initial response to that kind of stuff is always, no, right? Like, what is the point? And also that thing that you mentioned before, like industry being bad, like you're selling your soul somehow by going to work in it. And eventually, because of the realities of our world, as you were saying, you know, there are fewer and fewer academic jobs. They do come to see it, but there seems to be this knee-jerk reaction, like, no, we're not going to do that. That's not real work for some reason. And I mean, given everything, like, look at your career. Of course, it's real work. It's actual real work. Yeah. It's applied.
Right, exactly. Well, I think you have to realize that universities are cultures too. They have their mm-hmm. own incentives and sanctions. You have to follow the rules if you want to get hired, if you want to get promoted, if you want to get tenure. You have to do certain things. You have to publish mm-hmm. in academic journals. You know, you have to do this, you have to do that. I understand that, but most of the students that come through university at the bachelor's level will not go on to a master's or a PhD. So how does your argument square with them? So that's mm-hmm. question one. Then question two is getting them again to think about where they came from. What did your parents do for a living? Mm-hmm. And that helps them to see that this ideology that they hold may apply in a university setting, and maybe it works in that university setting, but they are not just training PhDs. Mm-hmm. And even if they were training PhDs, as you say, there aren't enough jobs for them now because universities are shuttering departments. Mm-hmm. So what are we doing to help them? And so we've come up at the we call it ACORN. At ACORN, we have been planting seeds, planting little acorns all over the place to help departments see that they can do both, that they can train whoever is coming through their programs for academic positions, but they need to be realistic that most will not get a steady tenure track role, and they need skills which the tenure track people could use too, by the way. So what are you doing to help them give a public talk? Are you teaching them to write op-eds instead of doing one more term paper? Are you preparing them? You know, you're great on data collection. Okay, what about analysis? Are you teaching them how to analyze data? I mean, we've collected a lot of data through the research we've done at ACORN, and we're finding that methods is something that anthropologists like to celebrate, except they're not teaching it enough. They may have a single course in some of these programs, and then they send you off to, you know, some other department to, you know, do the rest. Well, that's not sufficient. So there are lots of things that could be done that aren't being done. And our approach is to say, here are some things you can consider. You can bring in guest speakers zoom them in into your classroom. Mm-hmm. You can and invite people to come to campus to do workshops. There are alumni from your program who likely would be very willing to serve as some kind of a mentor or advisor to some of your students and possibly be a conduit for an internship. Have you reached out to any of your alums for those purposes? And typically the answer is no. Okay. Mm-hmm. How can we help you do that? And then we basically have a tool that we've created. These are what you might call a handout. I mean, they're, you know, could be one page, few pages long, and they're PDF, they're all PDFs, and they're available on our website for both instructors and then separately a different set for students. You look on the instructor page and you'll find, here's how you start a LinkedIn group for your current students, your current faculty and staff. And as they graduate, they will populate that LinkedIn page and you have your ready-made set of future alumni contacts who will help now your current students. Mm-hmm. You know, so, I mean, there are simple things that don't take a lot of time, effort, and energy. You know, do they have their students, let's say it's a medical anthropology class. Okay, how many of the readings have been written by practitioners? Practitioners write a lot and they publish in academic journals. Not all of them, but many of them. For example, that you've got, I don't know, it's a couple of hundred anthropologists that work at the VA system in the US. Those guys have to publish.
Yeah.
Okay, is anybody reading their stuff? Do you assign that in your medical anthropology class? That's just one little example. But, you know, in consumer research, plenty of anthropologists work in that area and they publish. Is anybody reading that material? Are you assigning it? Are you talking about it? Do you have your students profile practitioners? I mean, there's like a million things they could be doing and there are great models that are out there now. So we're trying to help those who want to be helped take steps so that they feel more confident in being able to talk about what we call anthropological practice. In other words, working outside of the university in various kinds of workplaces. We're trying to get the instructors to the point where they feel like, okay, yeah, I can do this. It's not that hard. And, you know, we're there to guide, to coach, to be available.
Yeah. Your website is fantastic. I will just tell people the website address is anthrocareerready.net. And all of these things that Elizabeth has been talking about are here on the website. It's very easy to find. I will say I was fascinated looking through the blog section.
Oh, yeah.
There's so many interesting personal stories here, a lot like what's happening on this podcast.
Cool.
And I feel like for many of them, I could just substitute the word linguistics
Absolutely.
For anthropology. And here it's just the same. I mean, where was that one that I saw? Hold on. Oh, this is great. From trowels to tech. How can an archaeologist work for a Fortune 100 company? And that's just exactly what linguists say all the time. They're like, well, I was doing field work in, you know, wherever, Guatemala or Siberia or something. How could I possibly get a job working for a Fortune 100?
Yeah.
And there are many answers to that question. So I love the sharing of personal stories here, because I think that really connects with people. They can look at that and go, yeah, I'm in a similar place. And you can take that advice to heart. So I just love all the resources that you're giving here. It's, as you say, it's not expensive. And I think that's a sticking point for some departments. They feel like it's going to cost us a lot of money. We're going to have to completely rejig things. You know, where are we going to find people to speak? And then you say to them, well, have you tried talking to your alums? And they're like, oh no, we never thought
right,
of that.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep.
And then you talk to the alums, as we have with the Linguistics Career Launch, and they are like, just so eager to come back and talk, but nobody's ever asked them.
Right.
And so, you know,
they're eager to be asked.
Exactly. So I love everything you have here. Just in your opinion, of all of the materials that you've developed for departments, is there one that you feel that's been like the most effective, or the thing that they see the value of it immediately, maybe from, you know, all the things that you were mentioning so far? Is there one that stands out to you?
Well, a lot of people have told me that they like the tool that's called What Can You Do with a Degree in Anthropology? And that's the million-dollar question that every parent and grandparent wants to know, right? And so this is a tool that you can use at admissions day at your university campus. You can use it with individuals. You can use it with your majors. You can, you know, it's one of these raising awareness tools that helps you see that there are very specific kinds of jobs for which you are qualified mm-hmm. because of your anthropological background and training. So I would say that's a very popular one. But, you know, it's really hard for me to pick. I'm too close to it.
One of the other things that you've done is to provide resources for class projects. So can you talk about that a little
bit? Yes. The University of North Texas, which is in Denton, Texas, north of Dallas, started finding clients for class projects a number of years ago. I mean, I don't know how long ago, but I know I worked with one faculty member in 2009. So at least as long as that. And the idea is that the class has, let's say it could be any kind of class, could be a methods class, could be an evaluation class, could be a capstone, you know, and it could be undergraduate or graduate. It doesn't matter. The class has a project that needs a solution. So the client has a problem. And maybe it's the American Red Cross, the local chapter of your American Red Cross. Maybe it is the Chamber of Commerce. If you have a residential campus, when I worked with the group, they were looking at dealerships, General Motors dealerships, so that you could be anywhere. And that particular class was an online class. So you can run this class project locally or virtually. It really doesn't matter. You find a client who has a problem and you say, okay, we'll put together a little proposal and we will do our best to try to come up with some ideas for you. And those ideas will be based on research that we have done. And the research is typically, not always, but typically involves interviews, but it could also be based on survey research. And it usually is complemented by various kinds of media, whether it's social media, network sites, your own website or websites in that genre of problem. Various sources of information. The students learn to collaborate with each other, which is a very big thing, because that's what the work world is like. You will collaborate, whether you like that person or not. You're going to learn to get the project done because the project has a deadline. And at the end of the class, the students then present using PowerPoint what they did, how they did it, what they learned, and what their recommendations are. It's very applied oriented. The client is there listening to the final presentation, gets a copy of the final presentation. And it's the students, I will tell you, having done this multiple times now, because we kind of sit along the sidelines and work with the instructor as the instructor marches through time that particular semester. And the students are ecstatic at the end when they've presented it, like they did it. They actually did it. They didn't know that they could do it, but now they've proven to themselves they've done it. And guess what? That goes right on their resume because it was a client. So the class-based, the client-based class project is a fascinating concept. Not only does it come up with ideas for the client to use, but it gives the students a chance to really do real work on a real problem, come up with real recommendations, and get that exposure that they need to the world of work.
Yeah, that's so good. And I mean, honestly, it should be part of every social science curriculum that they have, right? Like everybody should do this, because the best way to learn how to do those kinds of projects is to do the projects.
Exactly.
You don't know what it's really like until you get your fingers into it. And then you see all the twists and turns that happen. Just to call back to the LCL for a moment. One of the courses that we had this summer was working for the user design for olive oil labeling here in California. And so that's exactly what you were describing. Like it's a real project. It's a thing that has to be done. The class was going to work on it. And I heard anecdotally that the class was immediately frustrated up front because they weren't able to schedule interviews with the people that they needed to talk to. And it's like, hey, you know what? That's how work is. Yeah. Like sometimes you just can't get hold of the people that you need to, and there's still a deadline, and then you got to figure out what you're going to do next. And it's not a thing that you think about. And then, you have to learn that there are all these twists and turns that come with
work. Exactly right. It's a very valuable exercise to go through. You learn about project management. You learn about time management. And you learn how to deal with your peers, and you may have to have a little chat with some of your peers.
Exactly. I'm looking at the page on your website. I was searching for the thing that you were just talking about, what can you do with a degree in anthropology, which is a PDF, and I'll link to it on that same page, which is in the area that's for students. It's tools for job seekers and your career tools. There's also something called identify and rate your skills, which looks terrific. There's another one called What's in a Name? Job Titles to Explore, which, like with linguists, you know, linguists in industry are called everything but linguists for the most part.
Right.
So you need to find it. And then there's one here that's very interesting to me, which is what is your ideal work environment? Mm-hmm. And that's something that I spend a lot of time talking to people about, because I think it's a neglected area. Work has changed, work environments have changed, and it's really important to figure out what kind of environment that you can work in, but also that you can thrive in. Where are you going to be where you can do your best work? You know, do you like working on a team? Do you prefer working on your own? Is it 9 to 5 for you, or is it 12 to 8? Like all of those things are pieces of your work life that you need to consider. And they are things that you can use in your negotiations when you are interviewing for jobs, right? Like that's a thing that people have to learn how to do too, is that it's not just that they hand, it's not like in academia where they hand you a job and you're like, oh, okay, I guess I don't have a choice. In industry, normally there's some kind of negotiation that goes on, and the environment part of it is, can be part of the negotiation for this job that they would like to have you for.
Yes.
So I will link to that area of the website. These things are all really, really good. It's great that you've put these things together. They're very bite-sized. You know, they're all PDFs that you can just download. You can print them out or you can do it on your computer. And I think all of these tools will help everybody in the social sciences kind of figure out how to present your best self in your discipline to potential employers. Because as you were saying right at the top, it's still the case that employers need to be educated about what anthropologists and linguists and sociologists do exactly. Because yes. A lot of them are like, okay, sounds interesting, but what do you do exactly? And then you have to talk about it in terms that they can actually understand projects and time management and research and analysis.
Right. And you know, all of them have problems. They all have issues that they have to deal with, whether they're recurring issues or just, you know, out of the blue issues, whatever. And, you know, we have the skill set to be able to help them. Mm-hmm. We just don't always know that we can help them because no one has ever told us that that's would be a good thing to do. We've only been told to link to theory. So what we're trying to do is break out of that and say, no, you need the theory and you need the methods and you need more methods than you're currently getting. But really mm-hmm. where we're headed now is we need to be solving the world's problems. There are grand challenges, climate change, you know, name your favorite grand challenge. We need people from all disciplines working together to do that. If your students are not exposed to collaboration, how will they be able to fare when they're in a work environment and they've never collaborated before? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's just a lot of things. One other thing I'll mention is today we have finished what we're calling career tools for anthropology. And they are the very same tools that you were referring to that are available on the student page of our website. So there are 39 tools there. And that book is coming out. It'll be printed in 2 weeks. We uploaded it today, Career Tools for Anthropology, and you'll be able to order it directly from the AnthroCareerReady.net website. There'll be a special page where you can order the, we call it the workbook, because it is a workbook. Mm-hmm. It's, you can write in it. You know, it's not a book you don't have to, that you're not to use your pencil on.
Wow, that's great. I have to ask, like, how are you guys getting along with, say, AAA?
Oh, great. I mean, I was past secretary of AAA.
Yeah, I saw that in your bio.
And I have worked with the staff for years and years, and I know them, at least I know the old timers quite well. And that has not been an issue. I have also served not just in the capacity as secretary, but I've also served as an executive board member on three other occasions. So over the years, I've had a chance to work with a wide variety of academics, and you know, some of them obviously have views that are different than mine, but that's okay. What I am trying to do now is to help the discipline move in a positive direction, so that anthropology becomes a household word again. It was mm-hmm. when Margaret Mead was alive, and then mm-hmm, it kind of mm-hmm. went away. And I'm interested in getting it back so that employers will routinely include anthropologists in job descriptions so that they will have some idea of what an anthropologist is. I just ran into somebody yesterday, a couple of days ago, who made some, oh, you're an anthropologist. Oh, what do you do? Study dinosaurs. And I couldn't believe it. I just kind of walked by and didn't even. Uh-huh. So.
Well, that's very much the, you know, the linguist thing. How many languages do you speak? Oh, please,
yeah, really.
Don't ask
mm-hmm.
me that.
Yep. We have the same issues.
It's great. You guys are doing a lot of amazing work here. And I am hoping that we as the linguistics career launch, the other part of what I do, and also the LSA, you know, can see the light here. And we can work with you more because I think, you know, partnering up for these things only makes it more powerful, right? Like we, as you were saying before, we shouldn't be siloed. It shouldn't be anthro over here, linguistics over here, sociology over here. We should be working together.
Exactly right. And we encourage you as we've like advertised the linguistics career launch, and I've been a part of it in terms of being an attendee in the past. Mm-hmm. But we should be sharing information freely and talking with each other. If you end up next year having some sessions where we might be able to assist in some way, we would be more than happy to do that because some of what we have developed is directly applicable to what you guys are doing. And the same would be true of a demographer or a sociologist, maybe even a psychologist, you know, geographer. Mm-hmm. I mean, this doesn't need to be siloed. These are open and free for anyone. There is no charge. When you purchase the workbook, you're purchasing it right from Amazon. So, so there is a charge, for the printing costs and so on. And it's minimal. It's like $10. But other than that, everything that we offer is free, including the Speakers Bureau. So we're just a bunch of volunteers. That's what we are, just like you guys are.
Yep, it's fantastic. So much respect for all that you have done and will continue to do. Those are all the questions that I have for you today. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me about your career and all this other stuff. I think this is going to be incredibly valuable to our listeners. I was going to put your LinkedIn link in the show notes. Is it okay if people want to contact you with questions?
Yes, always happy to chat with anyone. And you know, we're doing more and more things. There are now three of us that are co-chairing the network. Ryle Nolan was the first person I approached when I had this idea, and he's been with me right since the beginning. And more recently, this past year, we asked Jennifer Studebaker to be a co-chair. So now there are three of us, and that helps to share some of the work, but we're always looking for others to participate in some way. So, or maybe we could, as you were suggesting, partner on something in the future. That would be terrific.
Yeah, we would absolutely love that. So we'll see what we can do.
Okay, great. Again,
thank you, Elizabeth. I really appreciate this.
Thank you, Laura. Nice talking with you.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held two online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.